I recently went to the doctor and the doctor said that I was pre-diabetic, which meant that a combination of genetics and choices I've made have led me to be pre-diabetic. We don't have like pre-addict. We don't have pre-alcoholic. In diabetes, they don't wait until you've lost a leg and then put you on diabetes medicine. But in addiction, we say like, it's not so bad. You know, like, yeah, pull it together. And then once you've had a car accident or your spouse leaves you, we're like, time to get some help. Why can't we early on say like, listen, part genetics, part choices you've made, but stigma free, where you're going, I don't think you're going to like it. So before you get all the way in, what choices do you want to make?
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scholfall. In this podcast, I speak to some incredible people about mindset, mental health, addiction, and recovery. And I share my own journey throughout these conversations. So whether you're on your own path of self-discovery, recovery or transformation, inspired by human stories of mental resilience, or supporting someone who is struggling with addiction, make sure you follow and subscribe to This Is Powerful. There'll be a new episode every Thursday. In these episodes, we will be talking about drug and alcohol misuse, suicide, sexual abuse, and some other heavy topics. So please take care when listening. Today I have a brilliant creative guest. Sean Daniels is an internationally known theatre director, writer, artistic director, known for new work and innovative community-based leadership. Sean is a leading voice in using the arts to defeat addiction and display the White Chip, a New York Times critic's pick, and Drama League nominee for Best Revival, has been performed around the world as a catalyst for community conversation and connection. We had a great conversation about addiction within the arts and debunking the myth that using substances fuels creativity. Sean, thank you so much for joining us on This Is Powerful.
Oh, I'm honored to be here. Thank you so much.
I was really sad to miss you in London and the White Chip play that you put on at the Southwark. I heard fantastic reviews about it.
It was really amazing to have the show over there, but not just to have the show, but Daniel Tarento, who was our producer, was really dedicated to being in the recovery community for months leading up to it, making connections. And the University of Oxford made this phenomenal website that lives on even after the show. It's a really, I think, a bold way of thinking about how we make theater in 2025, which is kind of not about transactional selling tickets to something, but really like how to be of service to a community. And that said, also English people don't laugh as much. So that was also the other thing to learn as a part of it. They enjoyed it maybe even more. They applauded more at the end. But, you know, Americans are, we're loud. So you just know how it's going a bit more during each night.
We are stiff customers, but I bet in the audience, if you had someone who was genuinely in sobriety, would have been laughing, I would imagine, but not as loud.
What's amazing in both New York and London, you always needed like a third of the audience in recovery because they would laugh at the jokes. You know, they would find it funny because if nobody is in recovery in the audience, it's a horrible story. I mean, this sounds like something you should avoid altogether. But just a few people in recovery laughing makes everyone realize like, oh, it's okay to laugh at this. Oh, this is enjoyable. And it's okay. You know, you can have a sense of humor about this. And so I think that's the great thing. There was always a couple nights where there'd be like one loud laugher and then suddenly the room would realize it's okay. And then they would enjoy themselves.
Yeah, I guess it's a funny thing, isn't it? If you're not in recovery, to know what you can laugh at. I remember talking to my grandfather about the very dark humor they used to have here in the Second World War. And I think if you've been through such adversity, you have the privilege of seeing the funny side of it.
Well, and you know why I'm really trying to, I mean, I run an organization that's dedicated to using the arts to talk about health and human services in recovery. But I think even more so than the arts, comedy to doing it, because I go to meetings And people tell these horrible stories and the room just roars with laughter. You know, people talk about they like tried to steal a helicopter and people are falling out of their chairs laughing. And then you see on pop culture or TV people in recovery and it's four people in a sad room in a circle chanting their name at someone. Like, it's so far from the experience. I totally understand why the average person that doesn't know anything sees that and thinks, that's not what I want my life to be. That seems terrifying that that's what is ahead for me. So I really also want to share the joy and the humor and that we're able to talk about these things and we're able to have a fantastic life, but you also can have a hilarious experience in life at the same time.
I remember watching Fight Club and seeing Meatloaf hugging, thinking, I would never end up in one of those places. And I think the first time I walked in to a 12-step program, I was miffed at the fact that everyone was laughing. And I thought, maybe this is a pre-meeting for something, and then they're going to do a meeting after. I don't know. I'm not sure. Would you be able to go back and tell us, Sean, where you're from and how your upbringing was?
I was born in Washington, D.C., over here, which is the capital. Both of my parents' families were in politics at the time. And we were a very conservative Mormon family, which is a religion that's larger over here than it is over there. But if you can imagine, it's pretty strict about everything. And so growing up, I just had trouble fitting into it. I wasn't good at following the rules. You know, I got sent at one point to like a reboot camp that the Mormon Church does for problematic children, which is hilarious because the majority of kids are sent because they're gay. I was just sent because I was troubled. And they really try to fix you through the power of musical theater. Like, you really try, you learn songs, you learn shows, you put them on. It had to be torture if you were gay and sent off and told to sing and dance. And that was going to fix you.
Yeah.
But for me, I was thrilled because I loved the art form. So I really, you know, for me, I was a big relapser and it took me forever to get sober. And part of it was my upbringing. Part of it was being in a really restrictive church growing up that eventually I left. And so when I got into recovery and everybody's like, oh, well, you know, God is going to be the answer. I was like, oh no. Oh no. If that's it, I'm in real trouble because I just don't think I can do that again. You know, I believe in ritual and spirituality and connectiveness, but organized religion, I really took a beating on growing up, which I think is probably a lot of people. And I think especially over here in the States, you're very likely to have grown up in a very conservative religious family and figuring out how that plays into your recovery later on.
After going to this reform, was that where you discovered musical theater? And is that where your taste for the arts came from? Or did you already have that?
It's a great lesson in like what you're introduced to as a kid. My family just always went to the theater. That was just part of who we were. You know, like you grow up later in life and you tell stories from your childhood and other people look at you like, what are you talking about? And you realize that your childhood was not like everybody else's. Like, we went to church for hours every Sunday. We went to Bible class during the week. And we went to the theater all the time. We were subscribers at all the local theaters when tours came through town. It was just something that my family has always enjoyed doing. And so I got introduced to it at a young age. And the theater is always, you know, it's kind of a place for the misfits. So it's just also, you know, a community to be a part of. And then I really fell in love with, you know, the experience of, which is so funny because it's so similar to religion, but it is like gathering people together. It is like a community there. It's people laughing at the same time. There's all these studies about how when you watch the theater, your people's hearts sync together. And, you know, people breathe at the same time or don't breathe at the same time. And so it's I fell in love with the art form, I think, pretty early on.
When you left the theater place that your parents sent you to, how was your sort of teenage years? When did you discover alcohol?
I was 12 when I had my first drink. And it oddly was, I was still deep in the church. And, you know, I so identify with this. There was this study of teenagers done recently that talked about like, who is more likely to become an addict later in life? And they said the number one determination of whether people were going to become addicted later in life was that if they felt like when they were using, they were the truest version of themselves or the best version of themselves. If you identified that, and I just think for me, like, I was awkward. I was a fat kid. I was the kid wearing like his T-shirt when we went swimming in the pool. And so just to have like a couple drinks was, I just feel like I fit in better. I was more charming. It was easier to talk to people. I grew up in the 70s and 80s. And so I'm sure I had ADHD at a time that like we didn't know what it was. You know, there was no medication. I was just like, I got A's at classes I was great in and D's at ones that I just could not wrap my head around. And so drinking in many ways helped. Drinking, like, you know, it calmed me down. And, you know, I was talking to a friend yesterday who is on day one of his sobriety journey. And I told him, I said, like, the thing I genuinely miss about it all is that on drink three, even as an adult, I could breathe. I could relax. My shoulders would go down. You know, it's like a self-medicating of what it is. Now, my problem was there was never stopping at drink three. Drink three was just the like takeoff point to drink 11. And the fight that was coming later with somebody. So, you know, I found it at 12 and it was helpful is probably what got me for so long, is that it was hard for me to wrap my head around this thing that made it easier to talk to people, to come up with ideas. And I think in the arts industry, we love a self-destructive person. We love this myth that it costs you something to be artistic. And, you know, like Hemingway was a drunk and we love that about him. He also, like, he put a shotgun in his mouth and ended his life. But somehow we leave that part out of it. We love Jack Kerouac, you know, oh my God, Amy Winehouse is brilliant, but it cost her. But of course it cost, you know what I mean? Like, we have this myth that somehow being an artist is this deal with the devil you make, and drugs are a part of it. And there's so many artists that obviously, like Terrence McNally and those that have thrived after they got sober. Also, as I got older and I worked more in the theater, I bought the selling point that this is just part of what it is. This is part of your deal with the devil to be the truest artist that you are.
Where do you think that myth comes from?
You know, I think it's been around for, I mean, Achilles, who wrote Prometheus Bound, so this is like ancient Greeks, is like considered one of the first like drunk authors. So it's been around since the beginning. You know, I mean, Dionysus, who is the god of, you know, theater, is also the god of wine. The arts are celebratory, right? You get a feeling that can only happen that you're there, that it's passionate, that. And, you know, I think that's part of why we love big personalities in the theater. Also, we put up, you know, I mean, I think we're kind of like the restaurant industry, and like, you're so glad you don't work in it, but you love the idea that somewhere a chef is yelling at people to make food better, you know, and there's a reason why that's popular on TV. But I just think, first of all, it's terrifying to be an artist, right? You have to put yourself out there. Everyone has thoughts and opinions about it. If you had an amazing amount of confidence, you probably would have gone into something else. So you're low confidence, but you're putting yourself out there. And so I just think it's a perfect setup. One of the things that when I wanted to start this recovery arts project, which is about using the arts to change narratives, I feel like the first part of it is making the arts safe for artists, because I just feel like, oh my God, how many people do we lose all the time? You know, we just kind of shrug our shoulders that it's just part of what our industry is, and there's no reason for it to be that way.
Yeah, it's really true. I mean, I've got lots of friends who are actors, and there's still a narrative batted around where, you know, smoking weed or drinking helps me get into a place where I'm creative. And personally, being on the other side of that, I think that's actually untrue. What's your experience with the industry?
There's this idea of post-traumatic growth, which other people have taken on, that I feel like is kind of how we miss the narrative. Because we always tell stories of like, it was great, and then I screwed it up, and now I'm getting it back together. And I think like the average person hears that story and thinks like, I'd rather avoid that altogether. Like, that's not, that doesn't sound fun. But you look at like, and I think we can learn so much from them, the like LGBT community, who also talks about post-traumatic growth. But they talk about that even though it was traumatic and even though there were awful events, now that they've come out, they are the fullest version of themselves. They are better parents, community leaders, neighbors, sons, since they came out, and that they could only be the fullest version of themselves now. And I think we have to adopt a similar thinking, because it's 100% true. You go to meetings and people say, I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. And I know for me, and maybe it's for you, like I can do so many things. I'm of course a better parent. I'm of course a better artist than I was before, because I'm able to be in it and I'm able to think and I'm able to have so many more hours in the day. And when I was drinking, I'd lose hours to nothing, you know, before I could really get started. And so I think we have to tell the stories of artists who thrived after they got sober. We have to talk about like how they couldn't do the things that they were doing before. So I always use the example of Terrence McNally, but he wrote this play, Frankie and Johnny and the Clair de Lune, which is redone on Broadway every 10 years. And he's got a movie coming out, Kiss of the Spider Woman. And it's like all of that happened after he got sober. And so there's none of those things happen if he doesn't, you know, probably a little bit more success comes his way, but in no way the life that he created and the number of artists that have thrived because of him afterwards. And so I just think those are more of the stories we need to tell, because if I'm honest, the last 2 years of my drinking, 3 years of my drinking, I would have told you that it didn't hurt my art. It's like something I believe deeply was that like, I'm still making great art. And it was like, no, there. I'm sure that it could have been better. I'm sure there were professional opportunities I missed. I'm sure there were people I was cruel to and spent a lifetime making amends afterwards. So like, no, of course it affected what it is. And of course I lost things because of it. But that's the part of the lie we tell ourselves, that even if it's costing me in my personal life, it's not costing me in my art. And 100% not true. At some point that was true. And then I passed that moment and lived in a lie for several years before I got sober.
I love Anthony Hopkins does an annual thing, doesn't he, to say, be strong and stuff.
I love it. I love it. He comes out and he's like, oh, by the way, I've been sober for like a significant amount of time, right?
Like, I think it's 45, something like that.
Yeah. So you're like, oh my God, like that's all in the time that he's been, you know, crushing it. And so we need more artists like him to come out and be a part of it.
We're trying to do a similar thing to what you're admirably doing as well, Sean, is breaking stigma. That's why we started this podcast, or partly why we started it. How do you think is a good way to break stigma in the arts? You know, apart from the obvious of what you've put on an incredibly good play, but how would that help people to sort of come out and come into sobriety, do you think?
You know, it's so funny. I used to have like a really good answer about anonymity. And I used to say, like, I only break my anonymity. I don't break anybody else's. And I feel like it's a personal choice. But I think the true part is that, honestly, I don't care. I don't care what two guys in Ohio in 1920 wrote about anonymity. Like, I just feel like that maybe worked for them and it was a different world. But over here, someone dies every 7 minutes. I mean, it's the number one killer of people 18 to 44. And for any of us that have ever known anybody that died, you know that like one person dying isn't just a like, it's not a number. It's a family. It's a community. It's a workplace. It's a church. Like all of them are ruined. So I guess I don't care about anonymity, because I think like step one is admitting you have a problem, and like we have a problem. And so like whatever we put in place in 1920 in Ohio is not working. I mean, 18 to 44, right, it's the number one killer over here. And just remember that that is overdoses. That's not alcohol. That's not liver failure. That's not people crashing their cars into trees. That is not domestic violence. So like the number is probably a lot worse. That number is probably through the roof in terms of what it is. And that's the workforce of our country. I mean, that is the people that are paying the most taxes. So I guess my thing about anonymity is like, it's not working. I'm happy to have a debate about it. But at the end of the day, like, if any other disease was killing people this fast, would we kind of like dance around whether we should talk about it or not?
It's very well put. Over here, it's something like 45% of the adult population are affected directly within a family unit.
Yeah, there's a terrible stat over here. It's something like 70% of people that overdosed and died were employed within the last 2 months before they died, which is the like standard thinking is that it's like a homeless guy under an overpass, or it's junkies, or it's people that have been not worked and strung out for a long period of time and it gets them. And it's like, no, it's like, it's a guy who was working in your office. So we're doing this initiative with the Clinton Foundation over here to put naloxone into Broadway houses. And we had this very moving, we had to get Broadway owners together. And then Secretary Clinton came in to talk to them. And they had asked her, why are the Clintons involved in this? You know, it doesn't seem like addiction is directly in their family. And she talked about they had a year where four family friends lost children to overdose. And as you can imagine, I'm sure the people that are friends in the Clintons' world are like every opportunity available to these kids. But she said some of them, they needed some help studying. And so somebody gave them a pill to help them do it. Or they ordered some Xanax off the dark web because they just were too stressed out about school going on. And then it's because of fentanyl, you know, you take one and that's it. And if your family doesn't know, they find you the next morning. And so it's stories like that that are we're not putting out in the world because, yeah, it's an easy problem to turn yourself away from when you think it's like, oh, it's somebody who's been homeless and they can't, not that they don't deserve help, but that's the narrative, that it's somebody who has been using for a long time, has turned down lots of opportunities to get help, and then eventually it gets them. And it's like, no, it's high school kids. It's people who, you know, when I went to college, people just gave you drugs at parties and you just took them. And not a great idea, but you just walked into a party and somebody was like, put a pill in your mouth and your only question was like, how many hours? Like, how long am I going to be on whatever this is? And now you can't do that. Now it is like one pill could kill you. I mean, one pill, if it has the right amount of fentanyl in it, that could be it. And if someone doesn't have naloxone, it's over.
It's interesting as well here because we're having the stats are that younger people are tending not to drink, but the ones who are on drugs are in a really bad way. So there's like a real kind of split. Whereas before, like what you shared, when you and I were young, it was probably more of a moderate pace. Is that happening in the States too?
The University of Michigan does this great study every year called Monitoring the Future. And it's kind of considered over here the standard by which you see like what teens are doing. And it's online. You can, all the research is there. You can look it up. Anyway, from 2000 to now, every drug is down amongst teens. Marijuana is down. Drinking is down. Pills are down. And overdose deaths are up, which means that less people are using in the United States and more people are dying, which means that it's killing people quicker. So, I mean, because it's a terrifying stat to see. You'd think like, oh, just on their own, this younger generation is not interested in it. Even to pot smoking, it's down. When I was, I don't know how old you are, but like when we got pot, and you had to like take it home. You had to get like an album. You had to pick the seeds out of it. You had to like, it was so much work to have to do. And then you would smoke it. And like the quality, the THC, the amount that's in it. I mean, just the amount, even when the kids are smoking pot today, it is through the roof of what we were doing. Like science has allowed them a different high than we were having. I mean, they can buy the wrong gummy and suddenly they're off on a, you know, an incredibly high place. It's a different game, and we have to talk with them about what it is that they're encountering, not what our experience was.
When was the first time you realized, maybe I've got a bit of a problem? Because it's always fun. I say always, but for me and most people I talk to, it's always fun in the beginning. It's part of being a cool cat. You get to feel like yourself. Anxiety seems to go away, but then always comes back. When did you realize, Sean, that it was a problem?
So late in the game. If I told you my whole like drunkalog story, you'd keep thinking at some point he's going to stop. Like I blacked out while driving home and I drove my car headfirst into a telephone pole And so I went to jail that night and I was charged with an aggravated DUI. And I had to get up the next day and go straight from jail to a work event with children. And that was about a year and a half before I got sober. Like, for the average person, you would think like that was a lot. You know, anytime you go straight from jail to a work event, you judge your life differently, maybe make some different choices. And I came home and the first time that somebody said to me like, well, I hope this doesn't turn you into like a, you know, a super conservative. I was like, oh, my God, thank God. And then I just picked up my drinking and tried to be smarter about it. And, you know, I was a day drinker. I was drinking in the morning and I on some level knew it was a problem, but also kind of just thought this is life and this is what it is. It was so helpful to me when I learned about the science of addiction and I learned that it's a brain disorder, because it genuinely to me, like, I can't even really explain to you why I thought what I thought, because I was getting up in the morning. I was drinking before I got in the shower because I was so hungover. And I wasn't reaching out for help because I just thought this is what I do now. This is how I go through with it. And I have to hide it. And I have to get better at, you know, hiding it. And I have to, okay, I overdid it a little yesterday. I got to taper it back. Like, it just was this obsession to keep using at the same time that I was trying to move everything forward in my life. So I really just held out until, you know, and I would go to AA meetings drunk. I had to lie to people and say I had quit and I was sober when I wasn't, because I knew that was the right thing to say. But I don't know. I really don't understand how I didn't think it was a giant problem and just throw my hands up in the air and like lock myself in a facility, until I had lost everything, until I took the elevator all the way down to the bottom. And then eventually I got sober, honestly, because it was the least painful path forward. Well, I was going to die. I mean, I wanted to take my own life. So I was getting sober was the least painful way. And so when I work with people now or try to encourage them, you know, I just tell them like, you don't have to take the elevator all the way down. You don't have to get divorced. You don't have to crash your car. You don't have to have your kids not want to see you. You don't like, you can stop at any time. Which is, I mean, of course, why it's a disease, right? Because I do other things in my life that have negative effects. And then I never do them again because, like, that sucked. I don't want that, you know? Like, I get in a fight with my wife about something that she really doesn't like. It probably happens, like, one more time. And then we have a second fight. And then I think, like, okay, I will remember. Like, I'm taking the garbage out all the time now, you know? It's like, but for some reason, it was an obsession. It was, like, a true mental obsession. So, yeah, I don't, it's hard to say like when I realized it was a problem, because on some level, very early on, and in some other ways, not until the very end, because I was really trying to do everything I could to stay drinking up until it was going to kill me.
It's a very weird thing. We had a wonderful guy on This Is Powerful before called Dr. Ryan Zephyr, who's a neuropsychopharmacologist, and he explains on there very clearly how your brain can get hijacked. And I love the science behind it. I think it's really important because it explains a lot of the process.
For me, the science was the answer, because I couldn't do organized religion. And suddenly I met this group of guys that was like, okay, well, here's the science behind it. Here's brain chemistry. Here's neural pathways. Here's dopamine. Here's how your brain organizes, you know, events. And so it was like, oh my God, that I can... And like, I have an arts degree from a state school. I don't really understand science, but it was a way for me to believe in something larger than myself and to understand that in the US, it's been a disease classified as a disease since the 50s. I mean, it's early on. We knew like, oh, this is a brain disorder. This is not people making rational, great decisions. These are people's brains who are hijacked, and your brain can get hijacked on anything. Social media, exercise, work, sex, you know, but for us, it's like we reward, you know, if you're a workaholic and you make $1 billion, like we love you, you know, like that's an American hero. Every story that comes out, everyone's like Steve Jobs, a terrible person, but he made the iPhone, you know, and we're all like, what a great guy. Sure. You know, he just put his energy into something that we value as opposed to like drinking and drugs, which we do not value, and will kill you, which is not to say that being a workaholic doesn't kill you also, or that you don't drop dead from stress or yell at everybody all the time. I'm fascinated, though, by that, because for me, the science was so huge. And you know what's amazing for me, and this is why I don't care about anonymity. So I recently went to the doctor about a year ago, and the doctor said that I was pre-diabetic, which meant that a combination of genetics and choices I've made have led me to be pre-diabetic at a point that you can still reverse it and you can make different life choices if you want, or you cannot make different life choices, but the doctor thinks I probably won't be happy with what my life looks like in the future if I get there. And I was like, this is the most amazing conversation I've been a part of, because we don't have like pre-addict, we don't have pre-alcoholic, we don't have somewhere where a medical professional tells you stigma-free, you can do what you want, but I just want you to know, here is the path you are on. And if you ever wanted to like pull back, like the doctor wasn't saying I can't eat red meat and sweets, I just should probably have less, or I should work out, or I should drink more water, or I need to balance my life out. And it was like, oh my God, why? In diabetes, they don't wait until you've lost a leg and then put you on diabetes medicine. But in addiction, we say like, it's not so bad, you know, like, yeah, pull it together. And then once you've had a car accident or your spouse leaves you, we're like, time to get some help. Why can't we early on say like, listen, part genetics, part choices you've made, but stigma free, where you're going, I don't think you're going to like it. So if you still want to be a casual drinker, before you get all the way in, what choices do you want to make? And it's so true, right? Because I have so many friends who don't quit because the idea of abstinence sounds terrifying and boring and none of these things that are true. But I understand that that's a great reason to keep using, right? If there was a way that we could convince them, like, listen, you need to pull it together. And, you know, like, I don't think I'm pre-diabetic anymore. So it's like, yeah, I heard it. I started walking more. I started eating better. I lost some weight. Like, I made different choices based on information from a medical professional. And so, like, how can we, for the thing that has been classified as a disease since the late 50s, do that for people who are, you know, addicts and alcoholics?
I love what you said, and there's definitely a place for that in some sort of campaign, because it makes no sense. You're right, since the 50s. And still over here, the narrative is, especially for men, that narrative of like, you know, you're not a man if you don't drink, and don't trust someone if they don't drink, and all this stuff. And that's still around quite a lot.
My father-in-law, who passed away last year, he knew I was in recovery. He came and saw my play, and he would still offer me a beer every time that we would go out to dinner, because he's German. And so, like, I think in some level of his mind, beer wasn't even drinking. You know what I mean? Like, that's not, you just have beer with it. You know what I mean? And so it's like, it just culturally built in a way that even though he knew I was in recovery, it just, the proper thing to do is like, it's part of our culture. It's part of his culture. It takes so long to undo those parts of a culture. My first directing job outside the country after I got sober was in Estonia. And they were so offended that I didn't drink vodka, like all the time. Because once again, for them, it's like, that's how you greet people. That's how you know, I mean, like, you are insulting the house by not drinking the vodka that they've made. And vodka was my drink of choice. So I'm not sure why the universe sent me to Estonia, because it was like, you're going to go into the heart of where vodka comes from. But like, people were genuinely offended. And over here in the States, right, like, we recently did a project with a professional sports team about recovery, because they wanted to be more recovery friendly. And the only caveat was, we can't shame people who are buying beer at the game, because beer sales make up a huge amount of what they do on a given day. But they want to be more recovery friendly, but also like, don't shame them for doing it, because that's how deep into our culture it is. I mean, in a capitalist society, like, selling beer is big money. In a restaurant, right, selling drinks is big money. So how do you put recovery friendly conversations forward when everybody's for it, but at the end of the day, like, we got to make some money to be able to do it. It's a tough conversation. You know, peanuts, right? Like if you have a peanut allergy, like we're on it. Planes over here will pull every peanut off of it. You go to a workspace, it's peanut free. You know, it's like we're able, and I'm not saying that everything has to be like alcohol free, but I think it just needs some awareness of what it is for people that struggle. What would it mean to not have to see alcohol everywhere you go?
It's very true. Can you tell us now what you're working on in the arts about recovery?
We do a couple things. We do like a reading series to try to support artists in recovery, to try to get things out there. We have October 22nd. We have a gentleman that wrote a horror recovery screenplay. So for Halloween, we're going to do a live reading of that, you know, because essentially recovery is a bunch of people trapped in a building with a monster, you know, so it's we're not that far from horror stories. We do like a geo-targeted social media campaign, which is just to say that like we collect stories of people in recovery and then we blast them into neighborhoods based on people that live there. So someone like you always tells you that recovery is possible. You know, we're commissioning writers to write additional stories about, you know, where people in recovery, I mean, 10% of the country, our country is in recovery. So theoretically, they should be at 10% of every place that, you know, when you're watching a TV show, right? And that just, we know that's not the case, right? If somebody's in recovery in a TV show, they're going to relapse at the end of season one. Like they only exist to be trouble to the main character. And then we're working on just like, how do we change narratives? So a big part of it is this putting naloxone in Broadway houses. So it's like, you know, you are over here, you are federally mandated to have defibrillators and fire extinguishers anytime you have a public gathering of over a couple hundred people. And nobody has ever seen them used, you know, it doesn't encourage you to eat more cheeseburgers or to start fires. But if you ever needed one, it's a way to keep the public safe. I'm sure over there you have fire extinguishers whenever you have public gatherings or places. So it's just like, well, how to have like naloxone in places, just so it also breaks down the stigma of like, here's what it is. Here's a way that people can, you know that the public is safe whenever you're gathering them together. There was a great study that was done about when people are struggling, they won't get help or even research getting help if they think that their friends, their church or their workplace is going to think less about them. So we don't talk about it at all until 3 a.m. when you're Googling rehab centers near me or rehab centers near where your loved one is, right? And so there's a whole level of conversation that, you know, if you have cancer, which is awful to get, and I have many friends that I've lost to it and who have beat it, but if you get cancer, like, you know right where to go. You go to the American Cancer Society. There are local chapters. You tell everybody. You tell people at work. You come up with a work plan. You people bake for you. Like we snap into action because it used to be that you were judged for having cancer, but we've removed that stigma, right? Same thing for HIV. Like it used to be heavily stigmatized that it was poor choices that had led you to have that. But people don't believe that anymore, right? And so there are medications. And if you are loud about it and you get the help that you need, it won't be a death sentence. It always starts with public, private, and pop culture. Those are the three ways that you move any type of narrative. So we're always trying to work on those three things.
That's brilliant work. If we've got any artists listening to us today that are thinking about coming to sobriety or do have a problem and maybe still thinking they don't want to let it go because it's their creative juices going, what would you say to them?
First of all, alcohol or drugs gives you a false question. It asks you, do you want to be like a fully formed artist who's like free to do any thinking, or do you not want to have the extra ability to do that? And like, that's not the question. The question is like, do you want to be an artist or do you want to be dead? You know, like when that is the question, it's a very different thing because my alcoholism tells me you'd be charming, you'd be talking to more people, you'd be closing more deals. And like, here's the truth. I would either be alone drunk watching TV at 4 a.m. or I would be dead. So like, those are my options. Philip Seymour Hoffman had all the money in the world and is dead because he couldn't stay sober. So his question wasn't, do you want to be a free-flowing artist or do you want to be trapped? His question was like, do you want to be alive or not? And so I just think that the answer is you will make better art by being alive than you will being dead. And there are so many artists that when they have the full ability to be present, to hear what their collaborators are thinking, to take advice in, to take feedback in, to challenge their own assumptions, they make such better work. And, you know, like, listen, being a real artist is exhausting. It's 20 hours a day. It's never ending. It's full of rejection. Like, you need all of your facilities to be able to get through that. If you really want to be an artist, you need to be focused. You need to have the full you there to do it. And that's not going to happen until you're able to really be present.
That is so brilliantly put. Sean, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you today.
Thank you. I love the work that you do. Thank you for having me on.
This is Powerful is brought to you by Stride Foundation. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com, where you can find links to resources that may help. You can also donate. Please make a donation. It will help us bring to you more episodes. Please rate, follow, and subscribe to the show. Why? This will help the algorithm make us more visible to others who need help. And share this podcast with your family, friends. Head over to social media at Paul Scholfort and at @this_is_powerful. You'll get to see what's coming up and you can get in touch with us because I love hearing about you. Thank you also to my beautiful wife, Dr. Federica Amati, the best producer, Shannon Delwich, to Eber Long, who does all the hard work in the background. Thank you also to Ria Musa and the rest of the team. Did you know also you can watch us on YouTube? Just search for This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scholfort. Hi, everybody. I'd really love to hear your views so that we can produce a podcast with the content that matters to you. It doesn't matter if you just joined us or if you've been listening from the start. We would love you to fill in the short listener feedback form, which you can find in the show notes. And let me know your thoughts on our podcast. It would really mean a lot. Thanks, guys.